From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Pope Francis was in Santa Cruz, Bolivia Thursday and gave a speech in front of a meeting of Bolivian and international social movement activists that sounded like a Marxist critique of the world's institutions. The Pope referred to the greed of capitalism as the devil's dung, said that the concentration of media ownership and the flurry of TPP-style free trade agreements were new forms of colonialism, and defended the sovereignty of poor countries against the wealthy and powerful. He also acknowledged that neither he nor the Church held a monopoly on the analysis of social reality. Telesur's Ryle Mora was in Santa Cruz and filed this report.
Friday is the last day of Pope Francis' visit to the city of Santa Cruz and Bolivia as he heads to Paraguay in the early afternoon. On Thursday night, he gave a powerful speech at a meeting with grassroots movements that people are calling his most radical yet.
Time, my brothers and sisters, seems to be running out. We are not yet tearing one another apart, but we are tearing apart our common home. Today, the scientific community realizes what the poor have long told us. Harm, perhaps irreversible harm, is being done to the ecosystem.
Before leaving for Paraguay, Pope Francis visited the Palmasola jail on Friday morning for a closed event in which he spoke with prisoners there. Rael Mora, Telesur, Santa Cruz.
The heads of the European Commission, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the Eurozone are set to review a reform package offered by Athens to its creditors. A European Commission spokesperson said Friday the lenders were studying Greece's proposal ahead of a meeting in Brussels Saturday of the Eurogroup, the finance ministers of the 19-nation Eurozone. Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras presented the reform package 2 hours before a midnight deadline Thursday, in which Athens would agree to meet most of the demands made by creditors in exchange for a bailout of $59.5 billion. CCTV's Kate Parkinson filed this report from Athens.
What's different in this proposal from the previous one? The previous one that was, of course, overwhelmingly rejected by the Greek people who voted. 61% of Greek people who voted in last Sunday's referendum said no to more austerity. They didn't want that previous deal that was presented to them by Greece's creditors. Well, in many ways, this new deal is even tougher because the previous deal was looking at 8 to 9 billion euros of austerity. This deal that has been drawn up by the Greek government is the equivalent of 13 billion euros of austerity. So in many ways, a much tougher deal, and that's left many Greek people feeling a bit confused. But the other way to look at it is that the previous deal was austerity measures that Greece's creditors were looking at in order to unlock the remaining 7 billion euros of Greece's bailout fund. But what Greece is now proposing is this new reform package, the 13 billion euros worth of cuts and tax hikes and reforms in exchange for 53 billion euros.
Kate Parkinson, CCTV, Athens.
Back in Athens, Tsipras met with members of parliament from his Syriza coalition Friday, urging his fellow anti-austerity party members to support the plan. We'll have more on that next week. Marathon talks continue between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries over Tehran's nuclear program. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met again to discuss remaining differences over the text of the deal. They were joined by EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini. Zarif described his meeting as constructive and told reporters that the talks will likely continue through the weekend, although he said that the changing demands of some members was an added difficulty.
Unfortunately, we have seen a change of positions as well as excessive demands from our negotiating partners. Moreover, several members of the P5+1 group are taking different stances, which is creating problems in the talks. We are making every effort to reach a good deal which would protect our dignity. We continue the negotiations, and if the other side works for a balanced deal, such a deal will be within reach.
Zarif said that, nevertheless, as long as the political will exists, The remaining differences could be resolved by Monday. His cautiously hopeful tone was echoed by Kerry and by British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, who said that the negotiations, although painfully slow, are making progress. Press TV's Omar Leski was in Vienna and filed this report Friday.
We saw this morning another round of discussions within the P5 plus one group itself. And from the remarks that we heard from Minister Zarif of Iran, it seems that these coordination meetings are taking place because it's difficult for the P5 plus one representatives themselves, particularly in the Iranian team's words, the Western members of the P5 plus one, to have a coordinated position on different issues. Minister Zarif was even quoted as saying that Iran is, instead of negotiating with the P5 plus one as a group, has to negotiate with each and every member who has its own deadlines. So it's very vital, it says, for the P5 plus one to have that coordinated position. Now, what's also interesting is the comments that were made by Philip Hammond. He was leaving the Hotel Kaborg where the talks were taking place, and he said that the ministers are going to regroup tomorrow for these talks to continue. And he also confirmed that the talks may and will actually go into the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So we're expecting these talks to continue. But in those comments, Mr. Hammond said that the teams have instructed officials, I think he means the deputies here, to continue working on the draft. And he used the word redrafting and said that they are going to start redrafting and clarifying the text. And he also said that Iran needs to make some things clear with Tehran. I asked sources close to the Iranian team what Iran's position is with regards to that specific comment. And I'll just read before you here, a source close to the Iranian team telling me that the Iranian team says, according to a source close to the team, that we do not need to clear anything back in Tehran. Rather, all people here need to make tough choices. So again, that's the position that was outlined by Iran. I'll just repeat that. We do not need to clear anything. The Iranian negotiating team says, according to a source close to the team, back in Tehran.
The number of people who have fled Syria because of fighting that has raged there for the past 4.5 years has now topped 4 million. That, according to Antonio Guterres, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, who described the development as the worst crisis his agency has faced in the past 25 years. And he added, the additional 7.6 million people displaced remaining inside Syria face worsening conditions and abject poverty. Daniel Johnson reports from the United Nations.
4,013,000. That's the total number of refugees who've now fled Syria, according to UNHCR. Barely 10 months ago, the total was 3 million. The refugee agency, which made the announcement on Thursday, sounded the alarm after Turkey released updated data on the number of Syrians flooding into the country. In a statement, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Antonio Guterres said his agency hadn't seen such a crisis in almost a quarter of a century. He was referring to 1992, when refugees from Afghanistan reached 4.6 million. The UN Refugee Agency chief said that the world's biggest refugee population from a single conflict in a generation deserved international support. Instead, he said, people are living in dire conditions and sinking deeper into abject poverty. Turkey hosts the greatest number of Syrian refugees, followed by Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, and North African countries. Inside Syria, an additional 7.6 million people remain displaced, many of them in difficult circumstances and in hard-to-reach areas. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
The leaders of the member countries of the BRICS group and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization saw the close of their respective conferences in Ufa, Russia, Friday. Their host, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, said that improving cooperation in the financial sphere is one of the priority tasks for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and noted the progress in creating the BRICS Bank as a center of project financing and currency cooperation. Putin said that despite the recent stock market volatility, China remains the engine of the world's economy, and he pointed to the massive U.S. debt, the world's largest, as one of the most serious issues facing the global economy. Latin America figured heavily in the activities in Ufa this week, and for more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua Friday. Tony, a pleasure as always, and as always, a lot going on in the world this week.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to keep up with everything, isn't it, Don? Yeah. And You were when we were texting each other before we started recording, you were talking about the situation developing around a disputed territory between Guyana and Venezuela, the so-called Essequibo area of currently it's on the maps. It's makes up most of Western Guyana, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But their President Maduro has been alerting international and national opinion to the threat from, I think it's ExxonMobil,
yeah,
is
Exxon
the,
Mobil,
the oil
yeah.
the oil yep. company concern that's trying to, in fact, it already has negotiated a concession. I think it's a 10-year concession to explore the Essequibo for
right.
oil and gas
right.
reserves. And of course, that I only learned about this the extent of this territorial dispute a short while ago, but it's actually a huge geographic area
yeah.
That's covered by an agreement from dating in 1960 that both Guyana and Venezuela will work within the international system to arrive at an agreement about the who has sovereignty over that territory.
Yeah,
so for ExxonMobil to go in there and explore is extremely mischievous, yeah.
Yeah, well, just for the benefit of listeners that don't know, what we're talking about is one of those colonial legacy conflicts that exist over land and territorial boundaries, like we've discussed with Peru and Bolivia, for example. And And there are others. And Nicaragua has some, for example, with Colombia, etc. And in this particular case, it was the UK coming in the 19th century and doing cleanup work over the colonial powers, Spain, Portugal, etc., that were, you know, being pushed out after the Monroe Doctrine and just by their own internal dynamics. And this one is one that's been festering, and it's a contradiction. Each of these are contradictions to the integration process. There are things where you have legitimate disagreements and some things where perhaps not as legitimate, but still a disagreement. And ExxonMobil, in this case, goes in, excites the disagreement, offers Guyana a bunch of money saying, you know, we'll pay you the money for this stuff that probably belongs to them. Guyana, the new president, says, oh, yeah, okay. And ExxonMobil's looking to clean up. Maybe a few politicians in Guyana clean up, and Venezuela gets screwed out of some piece of its territory. And I guess Maduro was saying, no, it's not going to go down like that.
Yeah, and he can very legitimately do so under customary international law. I mean, there's ExxonMobil has no case at all. And if Venezuela decides to bring some kind of action, I should imagine it's perfectly possible for them to bring some kind of action against Guyana mm-hmm. in the international system that will make that will render moot the agreement that ExxonMobil has recently signed with the government of Guyana. But we'll see how that pans out. And the Venezuelan government's interpretation of that is that it's a mischievous attempt by ExxonMobil to try and create division in neighboring countries, in countries in Latin America, so as to slow down or somehow sabotage the regional integration process. That's the Venezuelan government's interpretation.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of neat because usually it's state actors like the United States or, you know, their black ops, perhaps, not the official, but the state actors like the U.S. that try to excite these various contradictions that exist in places so that the corporations can go in and pick up the pieces. But in this case, ExxonMobil's doing it themselves.
Right. Yeah, no, of course, ExxonMobil probably has a budget that's bigger than Guyana's.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Guyana's a very vulnerable country from that point of view.
Yeah.
So then there's that, which is a very important development and very similar to the complaint by Argentina about
right.
British exploration in the area around the Malvinas in the South Atlantic.
Right. Same scenario.
No, there's all that going on, but I think it's fair to regard those developments as extremely negative for the region.
Yeah, what's cute about about it too is the agent in each case, whether the agent over history or immediately, as in the Malvinas, is the UK. It's a British imperial claim to land in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. So then, but to counterbalance those kinds of negative developments that are potentially extremely damaging, you then have developments like the participation of Brazil in the BRICS summit, and although it's not participating directly in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, obviously, the fact that the BRICS summit is happening together at the same time as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Russia is very, very important in terms of the establishment and consolidation of what the BRICS are calling the New Development Bank, which is essentially a rival to the World Bank, and also a fund that will be an alternative for developing countries or emerging economies, whatever the latest jargon is.
Yeah, there's a $100 billion currency fund that they're establishing, a currency exchange that would parallel the IMF's kind of functions, of baskets of currencies.
I've forgotten what the technical term is for that, but I mean, it is the alternative to the IMF, isn't it?
Or to the ESM. So, it's similar also to the ESM in Europe. It serves the same function, although that backs a single currency and makes the adjustments at that level instead of adjusting the currencies as against each other.
Right. So the fact that Dilma Rousseff, the Brazilian president, is participating in the establishment of those institutions is very important. And I think you mentioned, Don, before we started recording again, that the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has proposed that ALBA joins the New Development Bank.
Right.
Because he sees it as a logical development of the Bank for the South. And of course, the Bank for the South was originally an idea of President Hugo Chavez. Mm-hmm. It's been really slow getting off the ground. And I think it was first proposed in something like 2006. And I think it actually opened with a physical presence. I'm not sure even where it's based. I think it may be based in Quito, but in Ecuador, I'm not sure. But the thing is that the other members of the Bank of the South, especially for some reason Brazil, have been very slow about promoting the Bank for the South.
Yeah, Maduro addressed that. Maduro said, first of all, he invoked it when he was talking about the BRICS, joining the BRICS banks, that the ALBA countries should join, and also intimating that would be a method kind of them going in as agents for, a larger part of Latin America, Caribbean. He said that, I remember hearing, I can still hear it, he said, in my ears, with Hugo Chavez and Lula and some others that he named, Kirchner, discussing all of this. He said, and it was a very good idea and very needed and still is. And he said, and then it kind of stalled after Hugo Chavez died, Kirchner died, and Lula was out, no longer president. He said, and now we need to start it up, and this might be the way to do it, is by jumping into the BRICS bank.
Yeah, and ALBA itself, the ALBA group, the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, they've got their own ALBA bank,
right.
And that if they can link up the ALBA bank to this much bigger, stronger, more powerful financial institution that's backed by all the wealth of and resources of Russia, India, China, Brazil, and South Africa, then. And that'll be a huge advance in terms of the capitalization of the ALBA countries.
Yep. And interesting locally is that because Brazil is a member of the BRICS, one of the principals of the BRICS, you now have ALBA relating to Brazil, outside of like UNASUR and the other local organizations at a whole different level.
Yeah. And I think I think that, that's one of the most important things that hardly anybody, I kind of noticed it, you've seen it, but I think it's a detail that's going to take on more and more importance over the next 3, 4, 5 years. Mm-hmm. The way that, whereas the ALBA countries are continually having to compromise and reach through negotiations with countries of, for example, of the Pacific Alliance, like Chile, Colombia, Mexico, Peru, and the Peruvian president, for example, is in Spain now on a state visit to Spain, where the right-wing government is kind of welcoming him with open arms. Mm. Because they see the Pacific Alliance as the way they want Latin American integration to go. They don't want Spain, the right-wing government currently in Spain, doesn't want Latin American integration to go the way of the ALBA countries, the vision of the ALBA countries, which is based on solidarity,
right,
complementarity, cooperation. So the fact that the ALBA countries can kind of finesse the kind of dead ends that they find themselves up against in their negotiations with the countries of the Pacific Alliance by a kind of jumping over those countries and reaching out to Russia, India, China, etc. Yeah. And I think that's a very important development that will take on more significance as over the next 2 or 3 years.
Take a look at Brazil, for example. If you look at China as the major trading partner with the region, and you look at Peru as the dock where all the goods get placed onto the Transcontinental Railroad, the destination and the big market is Brazil, which leaves Brazil in a very powerful position with respect to that trade going on. They are the consumer, and, you know, look, we're not going to buy anything that goes through Peru, that's always possible, or whatever, and this is what we'll pay, et cetera. They have a great deal of market control. So now, if you can align Brazil and ALBA going forward, that shifts the center of gravity in the entire construct down there in favor of the left.
Yeah, and that was Ignacio Lula da Silva's vision, and Dilma Rousseff has kind of taken that over, but she's in a much weaker position politically at the moment as a result of some of which we've covered over in recent months. But in that respect, it's interesting to see that Dilma Rousseff proposed. You and I both remember very well that one of the important things to come out of the recent visit by the, I think it was the Chinese premier to Brazil, was confirmation of a transport corridor from Peru's Pacific coast to Brazil's Atlantic coast. Yep. And it was very interesting to see that Dilma Rousseff has proposed a very similar corridor, but this time with Chile, linking Chile's Pacific coast with Brazil's Atlantic coast. Mm-hmm. They're talking about linking the Chilean port of Antofagasta with the Brazilian port of Paranaguá. It's interesting that she's done that. I mean, it's possible that she's kind of trying to play off Chile against Peru, so that Peru doesn't. It's almost as if she's saying to Peru, "We don't want you to have a monopoly on the transcontinent, the transoceanic, the interoceanic trade route." Mm-hmm. And that's interesting in terms of the political interplay between the Pacific Alliance, of which Chile and Peru are both members, mm-hmm. and the Mercosur bloc, of which Brazil is obviously the leading power because it's by far the largest economy in South America.
Right.
And I just thought that proposal by Dilma Rousseff for a Chile-Brazil transport corridor was very interesting.
And they kind of have, you know, Brazil kind of has both ends of that equation covered, because as a member of the BRICS with China, you have the input coming from China and the output going to Brazil. If Brazil and China take a common position, then whoever's in the middle is more or less governed by that.
Right. So what's coming out of the, although the BRICS summit seems a world away from Latin America, in fact, and in particular in the context of the almost simultaneous Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, and that what's coming out of those two summits is going to have a profound effect on developments in Latin America over the next 3, 4, 5 years.
While all of that was going on, you have the entire situation that's been going on in Europe around Greece as well. Aside from the fact that you have two different models fully on display in front of the world, the way that the EU relates to Greece, on the one hand, to its members, and the way that these countries are, you know, building solidarity among themselves and between you know, each other's regional organizations on the other, with a very complex political and economic environment to work in. You have, you know, in the new bloc, a multiplicity of economic systems, political and ideological configurations, and some serious legacy issues of colonialism, aside from the underdevelopment that's both a hindrance on the one hand and a source of, you know, we have a lot of stuff we can develop, so we're going to make money for a long time, you know, benefits.
Right. It's difficult to see how things are going to pan out in detail in the current standoff that may or may not be resolved this weekend between Greece and the European Union. But I don't think there's any doubt at all from the point of view of the European Union that they, in international terms, they've suffered a massive public relations defeat.
Oh, yeah. That referendum was, you know, you had for a long time both Tsipras and Varoufakis saying that the opposition to, you know, making a real, credible, sustainable deal with Greece is not economic but political, because economically they should want to make a sustainable deal and be done with it and get back to work. And they proved the point by, they said, okay, it's going to be a political decision, then let's have a referendum on the political decision, the ultimate democratic political decision, and that and their response to it, I think, really revealed the nature of the European system.
Yeah, and it also revealed the nature of the progressive group of countries in Latin America, because
sure,
Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Argentina, Ecuador, and Bolivia all welcomed the no vote in Greece in a very, very public way.
Yep.
You know, and it's very clear that Argentina and the ALBA countries are very much in favor of projecting their solidarity and cooperation-based vision onto the international and global stage. And I just wish they'd be more assertive and perhaps even aggressive about it.
Well, they did have a roll call vote on it, essentially, when the Argentina forced that vote at the General Assembly last year over the Vulture Fund thing, which is, you know, related to the same neoliberal construct.
Oh,
absolutely,
Don.
And the whole world
wound
up against it.
The fundamental demand of the Greek government has been that they don't want to sign a new agreement with the European Union that doesn't include debt restructuring. And the absolute bombshell from the point of view of the European Union this week was that even the IMF acknowledged that the EU side had been negotiating in bad faith, because they know, and they knew years ago, back in 2010, that even then Greece's debt was unsustainable, and they still insist on refusing to restructure the Greek debt, which in any case is odious.
Right, which again proves the point that it was political and not economic. Bankers that are handling a massive loan whose repayment could affect the health of their own bank, generally, when they're working on protecting the interest of their bank, will restructure the debt in a way that is sustainable and marketable, ultimately.
Yeah. And so, and that whole experience makes the decisions that are being taken, that have been taken over the last few days and that will be taken over the weekend in the SCO summit, of especial importance for Latin America, because then it'll enable the progressive countries of Latin America to have a real alternative international financial structure into which they can progressively integrate their own financial and economic structures. And that's just going to make the current Western-dominated structures, the IMF and the World Bank, more and more irrelevant.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.